Well, good morning, everybody. It's good to see all of you here today. Appreciate everyone putting your time and effort into being here with us to study God's Word and to worship our Creator today. Starting this morning and continuing over the next few lessons, over the next few weeks, I want to challenge you to consider to own your faith. We're going to be considering what it means to own your faith and how we go about that process. And I invite you to consider these lessons, not just from a, you know, interesting perspective, but from a personal standpoint. This is about you taking the time and the initiative to own your faith. So this is a subject that I think we all have to go through the process of deciding what we're going to believe for ourselves, regardless of where we are in our life, whether you're in high school and in college, trying to figure things out, what you're going to believe for yourself in regards to what your parents have taught you, or if you're 65 years old and have been a Christian for most of your entire life. This is something we all have to take the initiative on. And it's something that I have tried to take very personally. I find it to be a tremendous challenge many times to own my faith. So let's talk about some of these matters. As we go through these lessons, we're going to be asking some tough questions. Tough questions about why we should believe in God. Is it reasonable to believe in the Bible as God's Word? Is it reasonable to believe in Jesus as the Son of God? And moving on from those more fundamental matters, we're going to be talking about, you know, how do we make decisions about life? How do we make doctrinal decisions about what the Bible teaches? How do we make moral decisions in our lives? And so those are going to be some tough questions, some tough topics we're going to have to work through. And I ask you not to be put off by the tough questions. Because sometimes in this process of owning our faith, we have to come to terms and confront some of those tough questions. What we're going to do this morning is just lay some groundwork to help us get started on this topic of owning your faith. What we're going to be doing this morning is talking about what it means to really own your faith. It's a phrase, a concept we talk some about, but we need to define it more clarity, I think. Then secondly, we're going to talk about the need to own our faith. Why is it that we do need to own our faith? And then finally, we're going to conclude with some attitudes that we must adopt if we're going to succeed in this process. So first of all, let's ask the question, what does it mean to own my faith? When we talk about that, a lot of times what we refer to is just having a sincere faith. You know, we want to make sure that we truly believe what we believe, not that it's just, you know, something that we don't really ascribe to, not just something that's just kind of half of our life, but we want to make sure that we have a genuine faith. And certainly that's part of it, but I want us to go a step further, and I want us to think about the process by which we evaluate our subjective beliefs against objective evidence to determine their truthfulness. Owning your faith is not just a matter of determining if my faith is genuine or sincere or real, but it's also determining what you believe and if that is actually the truth. So what we're going to do in this process is we're going to evaluate what we believe subjectively, which a lot of times is handed down to us through our parents, most often our parents, sometimes mentors or teachers or preachers, whoever influences us, evaluating those subjective beliefs against objective evidence. Now, when I use the term subjective to talk about our beliefs, I don't mean that what we believe is always false. What I do mean, however, that many times what we believe is simply based upon our feelings, based upon what others have taught us, based upon our likes, our comfort levels, and in that way, what we believe many times is subjective. But the point we're going to make is that it's not good enough for us just to base our beliefs off of those kind of standards. Rather, it's better, and truth demands that we base our beliefs off of objective evidence, separate from what we have been taught, separate from what we feel, separate from what we seem as or feel as comfortable. Now, let me make a clarification here. We're talking about owning your faith, making your faith your own, as opposed to making your own faith. The distinction that I'm making between that is we talk about owning your faith. We're not talking about blazing yourself a trail. You know, going down a road where no one else has gone before, adopting beliefs or ideas that no one else has thought of before, or discovering things that no one else has discovered. Because we're going to find that chances are what we come to is something that already has been discovered. A lot of times there's a temptation to pride, and we'll talk about this later on in this lesson and throughout these lessons. But we need to understand that when we talk about owning our faith, it's not a matter of coming up with your own faith, but rather it's about looking at what the evidence says and where the evidence points us. So if we were to define this very simply, the process of owning your faith is simply deciding what to believe and why to believe it for yourself. And I want to emphasize that the what is important because, after all, if you believe in truth, then that's important. If you believe in error, that's also important. But the why is just as important. Why should we believe in what we believe? And Scott read for us John chapter 4, which I think is a really applicable example of a group of people who made their faith their own. They owned what they believed. John chapter 4 is the conversation between Jesus and the woman at the well, of course. And Jesus tells her that, in essence, I am the Messiah. And she is so shocked by what he has told her about her life and the things that she has done that he has revealed, revealing that he is a prophet. She is so shocked by that she drops her pitcher there and leaves it at the well and goes into the city and tells everyone. In verse 29, she says, "Come see a man who has told me all the things that I have done. This is not the Christ, is it?" And so she kind of piques their interest in investigating this Christ further. Well, in verse 39, it says, "From that city, many of the Samaritans believed in him because of the word of the woman who testified, 'He told me all the things that I have done.' So when the Samaritans came to Jesus, they were asking him to stay with them, and he stayed there 2 days. Many more believed because of his word. And they were saying to that woman, 'It is no longer because of what you said that we believe, for we have heard for ourselves and know that this one is indeed the Savior of the world.'" Now notice that the Samaritans coming to faith was a two-step process. First of all, in verse 39, it says they believed because of what the woman had said. She had come into the city and said, "This man revealed the things in my life which were secret." Or at least to him, she thought. And so because of that, the people believed in him. But then they invited Jesus to come and stay with them. And then it says in verse 41 that many more believed in him because of his word. So their faith moved beyond just believing because of her word and moved beyond to his word. It says in verse 42, they say it's no longer because of what you have said we believe, but because we have seen for ourselves. That's owning your faith. Now, we're in a similar situation. Many of us here have inherited the faith of our parents in a way. We believe the same things that our parents believe about God, about the Bible, about Jesus, about the church. And certainly that's an element of faith. But we've got to work through the process of moving beyond that and seeing the truth for ourselves. Because after all, it's not enough for us simply to believe because of what someone else has taught us. We need to see this for ourselves. And the question I want to pose to you this morning is, can you say the same thing about your faith that the Samaritans have said? Can you honestly and humbly say that you believe not because of what someone else has taught you, but because you have seen and reasoned through these things yourselves? And the result of this process is a more coherent, grounded, and genuine faith.
Of course, we want our faith to be genuine. We want our faith to be sincere, but we also want it to be grounded in what is truly the truth. Now, before we move on to our second question, I want to make this point. That if we're going to succeed in the process of owning our faith, there are two fundamental assumptions that we must accept. Two things that we must agree on. And the first is this, that not everything that we hear or even believe may be true. And I want to illustrate this with the letters to the Thessalonians. If you go back to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, in this first letter, Paul encourages the church there to examine everything because of this very reason. He says, "But examine everything carefully and hold fast to that which is good and abstain from every form of evil." So he tells them here, and by extension us, to examine everything carefully. That's what we're talking about here. Not everything that you hear from other people, even examine yourself. Not everything that you believe may in fact be true. This demands a tremendous amount of honesty from us. Tremendous amount of just laying our cards on the table and trying to be objective to the best of our ability. This is what we must admit, that sometimes those who have taught us may be wrong. And yes, I myself may in fact be wrong. We must be willing to acknowledge that possibility, but that leads us to our second thing. And that is the conclusion or the truth that absolute truth is knowable, accessible, and defendable. So the first fundamental truth we must accept is that other people and ourselves may in fact be wrong. But the second one is the exact opposite of that. That truth is never wrong. And that truth is available to you and me. That we can know it, it's accessible, and it is defendable. So in Paul's second letter to the church at Thessalonica, he writes this. In the context of encouraging them to watch out for false doctrine, things that would shake them from their faith, he says to them, "So then, brethren, stand firm and hold to the traditions which you were taught, whether by word of mouth or by letter from us." Earlier, Paul told them and encouraged them to examine everything, because those things may be wrong. But here he says, you need to stand upon what is true. In fact, he uses the word traditions. The very word traditions means things that are passed down from someone else. Whether that's from the apostles to this church, or from your parents to you. Traditions are simply things that are passed down. And Paul tells them, those things are true. Therefore, you need to stand firmly on them and hold fast to them. In fact, they are worthy of defending them. So if we're going to succeed in this process of owning our faith, we have to assume that truth is available to us. If there is no truth, absolutely, and if truth is not knowable, it's not accessible, it is not defendable, then really this whole process is meaningless. Because after all, we're searching for the truth. And if the truth is not there, if it's not accessible, if we can't find it, then why even begin this process? So if we're going to succeed, we must accept a standard of truth. Whether that's God, whether that's the Bible, whether that's Jesus, or whether that is something else. Something must be our standard of truth. Now, let's go on to our second question. Why should we own our faith? Why is it so important for me to have this genuine faith that's built upon truth? I want to share with you two reasons that I think we see the importance of owning our faith. And the first one is that faith is an individual responsibility. In other words, faith is something that you must do for yourself. You know, we can inherit certain practices, certain beliefs, certain values from our parents, most often from our parents. But we cannot inherit their faith in the true sense of the word. In our Bible class this morning, we made a distinction between two kinds of faith. someone who says that they have faith, but they don't actually live that faith out. And we could argue that that's not really true faith. But we contrasted that with someone who truly believes what they believe, and they live that out. That is true faith. You can inherit the first thing from your parents, but you can't inherit the second kind of faith from your parents. You're the one who has to choose that you're going to have genuine belief and faith. A couple of examples to illustrate this. If you go to the Old Testament book of Judges, Judges chapter 2, the children of Israel have entered the land of Canaan, the promised land. And the previous generation was unable to enter because of their unbelief. And so they died in the wilderness after a period of 40 years. But the second generation was much different. They entered the land because of their faith in God and their faith in their leader, Joshua. And so in Judges chapter 2, it says in verse 7 that the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, who had seen all the great work of the Lord which he had done for Israel. Then Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110. Now notice verse 10. All that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work which he had done for Israel. Now, to some extent, the second generation that came after Joshua and his generation, in some ways they inherited the faith of their fathers. Many times they continued to worship in the or sacrifice the animals in the tabernacle. They continued to consider themselves the people of God. But notice in verse 11, it says, "Then the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they served the Baals, and they forsook the Lord." They could not inherit the genuine, true faith of their fathers. Though they may have inherited some of the values, they didn't inherit the true faith of their fathers. They did not know the Lord. And that's the point that I want to make, is that you must know the Lord if you're going to own your faith. And that's an individual responsibility. That means more than just being baptized. Means more than just going to Bible studies, worshiping with the saints. That means for yourself taking the initiative to learn who God is and to serve Him for who He is. What this passage tells us, this principle, that each individual in every generation must himself come to know God personally. There's a New Testament example I want to illustrate with as well. In Matthew chapter 3, this is years later, of course. Same people, though. This is God's chosen nation, Israel. And in Matthew chapter 3, the Jews are coming out to John the Baptist, John the Baptizer. And they're saying, "We want to be baptized." And it says in verse 7 that when John saw many of the Pharisees and Sadducees coming for baptism, he said to them, "You brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come?" Apparently, John saw through their kind of superficial faith. And so he said to them, essentially, "You know, why are you coming to me?" It says in verse 8, "Therefore bear fruit in keeping with repentance, and do not suppose that you can say to yourselves, 'We have Abraham for our father.' For I say to you that from these stones God is able to raise up children to Abraham." You cannot say, "We've got Abraham for our father, and therefore our faith is sufficient." They had Abraham for their ancestor. Abraham, of course, was the father of their faith. But just having him as their father was not enough. They needed to make their faith their own. And the same point is true for us. We can't say to ourselves, "My parents were faithful Christians, and therefore my faith is just inherited from them." You must bear fruit in keeping with repentance. You must come to know the Lord for yourself. It is not enough to believe in something simply because your parents have taught you to do so. How would you be different in that case, from this perspective, how would you be different from someone who believes the Islam faith? How would you be different from a second generation Buddhist because they're just believing something that their parents have taught them. The question we have to wrestle with is the faith that my parents have truly what the truth is? And the challenge for us is to search for the truth regardless of our upbringing and our background. Let me make this point. Sometimes we think, well, the challenge is mainly for those who have grown up in the church to make their faith their own. The challenge is really for second-generation Christians. And truly, speaking from personal perspective, experience, that is a challenge for us. But it's not limited to just those who have grown up in the church. Even someone who is converted from the world, if you will, has to make their faith their own. They have to wrestle with some of the same questions about believing in God. This is a challenge that every single person must confront for themselves. And along the same point, the faith is an individual responsibility because you and I are going to stand before our God beside those who have taught us as equally accountable to God. In Acts chapter 17, the Apostle Paul says in his sermon to those in Athens, he says, "Therefore, having overlooked times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all people everywhere should repent, because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man he has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead." God is going to judge the world through Jesus. And I'm going to stand equally accountable to God as my parents are equally accountable to God. That means that there is something else that's the standard rather than me or my parents. That means that Jesus is the standard. God is the standard. And so we must take great care here to make sure that we're not making anything else the standard except that which is truly the standard, and that is God. So the first reason we need to own our faith is because your faith is an individual responsibility. But secondly, your faith is going to be challenged. This is pretty much a guarantee in our world today. We live, of course, in a very secular world, a world in which we're bombarded with all kinds of criticisms of the Christian faith and doubt. And 1 Peter chapter 3 reminds us of the reality of this and that we need to be prepared to answer those challenges. 1 Peter chapter 3, in verse 15, it says, "But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence." Now, the first thing I want to say about this passage is that if you're going to be answering other people's questions, you've got to be able to answer your own too. If you're going to be able to defend your faith to other people, you're going to also got to defend your faith to your own conscience. If you don't know what you believe and why you believe it, you're not going to be able to fulfill this passage. As we've got to make the time and the effort to prepare ourselves, make sure that we know what we believe and why we believe it in order to do this. Now, three phrases here I want you to notice. And that's the first one is the first one we see here in verse 15. Sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. That's really the main imperative in this passage. The main imperative is not give a defense or give an answer. The main imperative in this passage is sanctify Christ as Lord. That means make him your master and Lord. That is an individual responsibility too. Goes back to our first point. You've got to make sure if you're going to fulfill this passage, that you've got to make sure that you are submitting for yourself to Jesus as Lord. This is something that you must do. Secondly, he says, in response to that, as kind of an implication of that, always be ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account. Be ready to give a defense. Now, this is not just a personal testimony where you give your story of conversion or where you tell someone how you feel about Jesus, but rather this is a reasoned argument and logical explanation. That word defense actually is the word that means a logical explanation. Kind of like what you would find in a court setting. If you were in a court setting, if a lawyer were to stand up and give a defense based upon simply how he feels about the matter, that argument wouldn't hold water. But if he gave a reasoned argument based upon the evidence that was clearly presented, then that would be a compelling reason to accept what he says. The same is true for when we talk to people. We don't just present people with what we feel about Jesus. We present with people the reasonable explanation for why we feel that way about Jesus, why we have come to have faith in Jesus. And this, of course, demands rigorous self-examination and preparation. And then he finally says in this verse, yet with gentleness and reverence. And that's very important, because this is not just about winning an argument. Instead, it's about winning people to Christ. It's about bringing people, calling people to sanctify Christ as Lord in their hearts, like we have done. And you're not going to win them to Christ by making these arguments, by making these explanations, giving these explanations with harshness and with hatred. Rather, it's going to be done by gentleness and reverence. We've got to make sure that we're humble when we do this. Attitude is very, very key, not only when we're talking with people, but also when we're making faith our own. And that leads us to our third question this morning. What kind of attitude should I have when I am making faith my own? Three proper attitudes I want to share with you really quickly. And the first of these is honesty. You know, this is absolutely critical. If we're going to own our faith, we're going to have to be honest in every area of our lives. I'd like to illustrate this with Nathanael, back in John chapter 1. In John chapter 1, Jesus is being introduced to the world. And Philip, Jesus says to Philip, follow me. And so Philip goes and tells Nathanael about Jesus. And Nathanael says, can anything good come out of Nazareth? So he's skeptical of this message that Jesus is the Christ. And so Philip says to him in verse 46, come and see. And verse 47, Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him, and he said to him, behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no deceit. I want you to notice what Jesus says about Nathanael and about his character. Of course, Jesus knew who he was before he even met him physically. But he looked through his heart and he said, this is a man who is honest. Here's a man who's not going to deceive himself. He's not going to try to deceive others. Here's a man who is honest. Now notice, he doubted. But his doubts, his skepticism, what is honest skepticism? Can anything good come out of Nazareth? This is a podunk town where, you know, it's not necessarily a sinful place, but it's just not, you know, your big city on the map. And if the Christ is coming, is he going to come from a place like that? And so he doubted, but Jesus said to him, this is an honest man. Even in your doubts, can Jesus say of you that you are truly a person in whom there is no deceit? Are you being honest? There are three areas in which we need to be honest. First of all, we need intellectual honesty. That means we must ask ourselves, does this conclusion logically follow the premise? And even, is the premise itself true? Am I willing to admit that something is reasonable and true, even if I don't agree with it? Even if it means I'm wrong, or even if it hurts my own case? If we can answer yes to that, then we're being intellectually honest. Secondly, we need emotional honesty. That means that we've got to ask ourselves, am I reacting emotionally to this argument? Am I reacting emotionally to this truth? Am I saying that I don't believe it just because I don't like it? Because it makes me uncomfortable? Am I reacting out of pride, out of fear, out of prejudice, out of my preconceived ideas? And if I'm willing to acknowledge that, then am I willing to put aside my emotions for the sake of following what is true? And then finally, and perhaps most importantly, we need spiritual honesty. We need to ask ourselves, is sin clouding my judgment? Many times we doubt, not because we've got, you know, logical reasons, but because there's something in my life that I want to justify. And I want to cover that up. And maybe I'm masking my sin. Maybe I'm masking something, the error in my life, by these questions or by these doubts. And so am I using this as a way to justify my sinful choices? Am I more motivated by hurt, by guilt, by anger against somebody, rather than a sincere desire for truth? And this dishonesty can happen even to the best of us, because we're human. And so it's a constant challenge for us to ask ourselves, am I truly being honest in this search for truth? But Nathaniel's example tells us that truly we can be people if we try, diligently make it an effort to be honest, people without deceit. The second attitude we need is humility. I mentioned a few moments ago that navigating these issues can be sometimes a temptation to pride. This can be a very turbulent process. And there's a lot of fear that sometimes goes into this. You know, we've got to kind of overcome this fear that, you know, what if I'm wrong? I don't want to engage in asking these questions, because what if I find out that what I believe in my entire life is wrong? Well, that wouldn't be a bad thing. In fact, that would be a very good thing. And so humility tells us that we need to engage in this process thinking not too highly of ourselves. So in Romans chapter 12 and verse 3, Paul says, "For through the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you, not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment, as God has allotted to each a measure of faith." And again in James chapter 4 and verse 6, "We are likewise encouraged to be people of humility." James chapter 4, verse 6, "But he gives a greater grace. Therefore, it says, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble." I want to tell you that if you truly want to own your faith, you're never going to be able to do it unless you're first humble. Unless you first come to the table and you're willing to acknowledge that I don't always have the answers. That yes, I might be wrong sometimes. And so there are two areas in which we need humility. First of all, we need humility before other people. What I mean by that is, don't think you can't learn anything from someone else. Even from someone that you disagree with. You might be able to learn something, in fact, learn that someone has a piece of truth that you do not have. Don't think your ideas are more important than others. Sometimes, again, in this process of asking a lot of questions and challenging our own faith and maybe even challenging other people's faith, we like to ask the questions. We like to be heard. But it's also even more important for us to listen to others. Don't think that you're the only one who hasn't wrestled with these questions before. And let me make this point as well, that humility before our parents is probably most important in this aspect. If we're going to be humble before anybody, we need to be most humble before those who have taught us, those who have raised us. Because our parents have sacrificed so much in order to bring us to where we are. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that what they've taught us is true, but that does demand of us some gratitude. It does demand of us that we listen to those who love us, listen to those who have given so much to us, and give them a fair hearing. We need to be especially humble before our parents. After all, that's what honor your father and mother demands. And of course, we need humility before God. Humility to recognize that He is in heaven and we are on earth. We need to pray to God. We need to study about Him. We need to submit to the clear teachings of the Word and the evidence which points us to its truth. Let's keep in mind that God is the one who has all the answers, and not necessarily us having all the answers. If we're going to succeed, we must have humility. And then we must also have a hunger for truth. We must hunger persistently for truth. Jesus says to us in Matthew chapter 5, in His Sermon on the Mount, beginning this sermon, telling us really the characteristics of those who are kingdom citizens. He says in verse 6, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. It is those who have this hunger for truth that are going to find the truth. Now, compare the hunger that for truth that we ought to have to our physical hunger. And there's a couple of principles we need to keep in mind. First of all, are we hungering for the right thing? Now, you might be hungry right now, but are you craving the right kinds of foods that are really going to help your body? Are you hungry for donuts? Are you hungry for pizza? Now, just thinking about those things kind of makes us desire those things. But the point that I'm making is, are those the right kinds of things that we ought to be hungering for? Not saying it's wrong to eat donuts and pizza. But are those things really good for us all the time? Are we hungering for the right things? Jesus says here that we need to hunger and thirst for righteousness. If we're not hungering for truth, then what are we hungering for? Are we hungering for just the fact that, you know, people will look at us and say, that's a smart person? Are we hungering for acceptance from our peers, our family? What are you hungering for? Are you really hungering for the truth? And then secondly, we must ask, is hunger something that we're using just kind of as the end of itself? Or are we using hunger as a means to the end of God? Again, think about physical hunger. We hunger, but we're not built just to hunger. Our physical bodies are made to crave food so that we can function and we can serve God. In the same way, we are to hunger and thirst for knowledge, for truth, not because that's the end in and of itself, but because that truth and that knowledge leads us to the one who made that knowledge, the one who is the source of all that knowledge, learning truth and understanding truth. In fact, this whole process we've been talking about of making faith your own is not just about saying, I know, but ultimately it's about saying, I know God. That's what this is all about. Learning is not just an intellectual or spiritual exercise. And so we need to use this hunger. If we have a hunger, if we have a thirst for something, we need to use that to point us to what is really the truth. And so this morning, I just encourage you to think about your need to make your faith your own and ask yourself, do I have honesty to do that? To ask those hard questions, to answer them in a proper way. Do I have humility before God and before others? Am I truly hungering for that which is true? I want to close with a parable Jesus speaks in Matthew chapter 13. Very brief parable, but I think it punches a powerful point. Matthew chapter 13 and verse 45. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking fine pearls. And upon finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had, and he bought it. And the simple point I want to make is this, that searching for truth is a long and hard and sometimes arduous and painful process. But nothing, nothing is more worth it than finding that truth. Just like this man who spent his entire life searching for one pearl that was worth more than anything else he owned. Once he found it, he could look back and he said, that was worth it. So worth it that he was willing to sell everything that he had just to own that one pearl. And that pearl is God's truth that we're hungering for, that we're searching for. So maybe you're searching for something this morning. You're hungering for something that you have not found yet. We'd love to sit down with you and talk with you about how God and Jesus and his gospel fulfills that yearning and that hungering for something. Maybe you know what the gospel is, and you know what it teaches. You know that it teaches that Jesus is the Son of God. You know you need to be baptized because of your belief in that, and you need to walk with Christ. This is an opportunity for you to make that choice. If you have any spiritual need, we invite you to come to the front as we use the song to encourage you.